Welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. This podcast is brought to you in association with Game Refinery. Join us as we uncover the latest trends in mobile game design.
Hello and welcome to the Mobile Game Dev Playbook. Thanks for tuning in for another episode. Remember, this is a podcast that provides insights into what makes a great mobile game, what is and is not working for mobile game designers, and all the latest trends. I'm your host, John Jordan, and today's topic is mobile game economy design. Come back. This is fascinating stuff. We're going to talk about how developers can maximize their revenues by ensuring their in-game economy is the best, and that's the best for players, both players who pay money and players who don't pay money. So today we're going to be chatting about some of these key considerations when designers are thinking about planning their economies and when they're actually implementing them and creating an ideal balance, because it's about monetization, but also that has to work with engagement and retention. Everything needs to work together if you're going to be successful. So joining me this week is Erno Kiski, who's the chief analyst for the US at Game Refinery. How's it going, Erno?
It's going great. Thank you. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah. Ready for this one, up for this one. And our kind of expert guests are Dave Roll, who's the CEO of Mobile Game Doctor, and Raymond Holmes, who's a consulting designer at Mobile Game Doctor. Hello, guys. How's it going?
Great. Thank you so much for having us on.
Good, good. So I guess before we start off, let's get a bit of background on our guest experts. So Dave, you don't have to go through your entire history because that'll be a whole podcast. But can you give us the potted history and tell us don't be bored of telling us about Crazy Dave, because Crazy Dave is a good story that listeners will be interested in.
All right, sounds good. So I've been in the game industry now since about 1994. Got my start doing edutainment CD-ROMs at the Learning Company back in the 90s. Wound up doing some successful games there, managed the Oregon Trail brand for a while. Got excited about games on the internet in 2000, went to Pogo, was there about 6.5 years, among other things, started and ran their digital download business, started PopCap's first remote studio in downtown San Francisco. One of my teams there built the game Plants vs. Zombies, where they immortalized me as the character Crazy Dave. So that uses up about 14 minutes and 59 seconds of my 15 minutes of fame. From there, got excited about games on Facebook, was a design director at Zynga, worked on the Word Game portfolio and Zynga Poker. In the Facebook gaming days, went to Playdom as an executive producer and creative director. Then went to an early HTML5 gaming startup. When that went belly up, I kind of got the entrepreneurial bug. In mid-2014, I started Mobile Game Doctor, basically flying around consulting on free-to-play mobile game projects, mostly on the design side. And since then, have been working on and growing that business, helping game developers all over the world improve their game design, product management, marketing, and get better outcomes.
Thank you very much. Raymond, I realize I've done this in the wrong order, because in any other podcast with 24 years of game design expertise, you'd be the veteran, but I've kind of paired you against against Crazy Dave, which is probably the wrong way around. But what have you been doing in 24 years of the games industry?
Yeah, I started in games in 96 with PC games, actually worked on Tetris, versions of Tetris, did some early console, and then about 12 years ago, I got a job at Zynga, and that started my free-to-play journey that I have been pretty much on since. I was the designer on Farmville, which is sort of a dubious position in my mind, but there you go.
Cool. No, Farmville, very, very, very famous game. Cool. So we have two absolute experts. That's great. But to kick us off, to get some kind of high level trends, Erno, do you want to tell us what's been going on, I guess, kind of more recently in the world of free to play monetization?
Yeah, definitely. So if we start by looking at the free to play monetization and kind of like the different types of games and so on. So traditionally, of course, if you're talking about casual games, casino games, and so on, those games have been monetized through the core gameplay. So basically, you have your match three games with your boosters and continues, or you have your energy restrictions on a gameplay and so on. And then if we're looking at the mid-core, hardcore stuff, most of those games have been monetized through the meta layers with the gachas and collections on characters and items and upgrades and stuff like that. But if you look at the trends in the recent years, is especially in the casual games, we have seen the rise of the meta monetization also in the casual games. So, for example, look at any of the top grossing 100 casino games nowadays. All of those have different kind of like a collectible elements. You are collecting, for example, some stickers or something, completing collections, and then get rewards from completing that. Or let's say Yahtzee with buddies of scope, you are collecting pets, and those doesn't actually have a direct impact on the gameplay, but it gives you this another progression layer on top of the core mechanics. Then of course some upgrading mechanics have been coming to the casual gameplay. So like, for example, Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery is a good example of basically being a interactive story, like 2.0. So interactive story game, story is the main element, but then you have a lot of different kind of upgrading elements, and then of course different ways to monetize through that. And then of course building stuff. We saw Gardenscapes, Homescapes bringing these building metas on top of the actual match tree core gameplay. Or for example, one of the top hidden objective game currently in the market, June's Journey. It's basically just a hidden objective game, but it has a huge a building meta on top of that, and all the events that they are running, they are selling the special buildings that then you can build your own a home garden and so on. Then, of course, another then trend on top of that on casual games is the increase of increase of session length and engagement in the gameplay. So, like I said, of course, it has been the restrictions of gameplay have been quite heavy back in the day. But nowadays, if you look at, for example, the top match three games, they have various different types of events running constantly on top of the actual gameplay, increasing the session length and then monetizing through the pain points with the events. So for example, let's say the win streak events, which is basically in all of the top match three games nowadays, you have your win streak events on top of the actual gameplay, and then of course through the fear of losing out your win streak, they are able to monetize through that. Then of course looking at the mid-core stuff a bit more, elements also taken from the casual side. So if you look at our statistics, for example, with the ad monetization, is something that mid-core games in the West especially, it wasn't so common, but it's getting more and more common. So for example, games like Call of Duty Mobile has already ad monetization stuff implemented in those games as well. Just one example. And then of course through the huge increase in the shooter genre of battle royale games and so on. So those games, of course, are monetized through the cosmetic economies and the cosmetic monetization. So that is also, if you're looking at the feature data and what kind of things are sold to the players, the skins and different kind of accessories and so on are increasing in the popularity quite a lot. And then just as the last few data points from our system, so, for example, battle passes. Everybody's talking about it. Different ways of implementing battle passes in all around genres. So we saw, of course, the battle pass being a cosmetic economy feature on top of the battle royale genre, like Fortnite and so on. But nowadays, if you look at the market, we see it all around in the genres. In an actual number, if we are looking at, for example, the Top Crossing 100, we see 37% of all the games in Top Crossing 100 in the US iOS nowadays have a battle pass. And there's a 24% year-over-year increase of utilizing this feature. And of course, why it works is because it's basically an engagement feature, it's a progression feature, and it's a monetization feature. So yeah, that's some of the data points, for example, that we have seen in the trends following the market.
Quite a lot to unpack there. I mean, I guess broadly we can see there's a lot of cross-pollinization, whether that's kind of geographically, and a lot of mashing up of genres as well. Dave and Raymond, how do you, is that the kind of similar things you see that have been happening?
The nice thing about the battle pass is that it creates this sort of feeling with the player that that they're losing out on something, and usually it's a very small amount that they go for, and because it's a reoccurring charge, it's pretty easy to see why it would be popular among other games.
Dave,
so one of the things that's interesting to me, I think we've seen a lot of rapid evolution in terms of the mechanics of monetization, right? As Erno just called out, right? We've seen, monetization direct gameplay, we've seen monetization construction. One of the things that has really struck me over time, and I've done a few lectures on this at different conferences, is that there's actually a lot of consistency around what the player motivations for monetization are, why players want to spend, how we turn that into a transaction, right? I think is varies and grows over time. But I've got a little sort of mnemonic that I use to think about why players are monetizing. So the mnemonic is CAPS, and that stands for cosmetics, right? How do players appear? How do they look? How do they show themselves and sort of peacock to other players? Access, how do you get to content? How do you speed up through a grind, or how do you get access to exclusive content? Power, how do you gain an edge in a PvP match, or how do you get a little extra boost to get through a difficult level? And lastly, status, what can you do that raises you up in the eyes of the community as a high achiever in the game, right? And each of those kind of four motivations has, less monetization potential on a per player basis than the one that follows it. So to me, one of the things that works really well about battle passes as a monetization approach is that they sort of combine the cosmetic desire, the desire to be seen by other players, the want for players to check you out and say, hey, that guy looks cool, he looks impressive, he looks badass, along with status, because in order to get the top rewards in any battle pass system, right, you've got to achieve heavily in the game. You've got to play heavily, you've got to make progress, you've got to play all the levels to get to those big rewards and be able to show off. So for me, the fact that it's hitting both of those nerves is a lot of what makes it a really strong monetization mechanic.
Good, that's a good framework. I guess we can use to think about that, because I guess kind of from the trends that kind of Erno was talking about, what we've seen kind of broadly, I guess, over the last couple of years is what we thought of as kind of casual games, whether that was the right term or not, another podcast, but those kind of casual games taking on some of the monetization and similarly retention and engagement techniques that were kind of broadly seen as being more engaging and from more core games. So do you think those kind of that kind of caps kind of framework, does that work? How does that change kind of per genre? Because obviously, even though there is this kind of mashup sort of cross-pollination happening, that there are still kind of genres of mobile games have quite obviously different audiences, appeal to different audiences, and presumably that also then feeds through to the psychological attractions that audience have.
Yeah, a lot of it I think goes to what are players looking to the game for. All of those motivations exist among all audiences, right? Everybody wants to show off. Some games are better or worse at facilitating that. So when you think about cosmetic monetization, there are some really important design precursors. You need visibility of other, right? You want to be able to see the other players that are playing the game. Otherwise, what's the point of looking good? You're dressing up for yourself in a mirror. Ideally, you want to have some degree of self-visibility so you can see how cool you look, right? This is one of the things that, Fortnite does really well relative to, say, Apex Legends, right? That third-person camera versus first-person camera really lets you see how cool you look as you go through the game. Some hardcore audiences that are really focused on games as a kind of contest of skill and dominance are very resistant to power-based monetization culturally. Right? You start hearing a lot of noise about games being pay to win from more hardcore audiences. So although that same motivation is there, that kind of cultural tolerance and acceptance of it isn't. that's one of the reasons that you don't see, you know, power monetization in a lot of MOBAs and a lot of more core head-to-head PvP kinds of games, why they're so cosmetic focused, because even though you can generally monetize power a little more strongly, the community is just not very accepting of the selling of that power.
That makes sense. So in terms of kind of your role as the mobile game doctors, Raymond, when you're kind of looking to you know, when companies are kind of bringing you in, obviously there'll be lots of kind of specific things based around the specific game or the genre that they're trying to do. But on a broader level, are there any kind of things that you basically see a lot of game designers getting wrong about economy? Is there any kind of like top level stuff that's the kind of the low hanging fruit that you kind of just see all the time?
I would say the thing that I see the most is that people don't realize how much of their economy they can model beforehand and have a full understanding of where all of their, you know, their sources and sinks are, what the flow of the game is, and sort of tracking all the components in a way. And so one of the things I often help them with is figuring out how to model that, usually in Google Sheets or Excel, to create sort of a tool where they can check out these numbers. And I think the other thing that I see a lot is sort of the whole kitchen sink theory, where they see something in another game that's doing really well and they want to throw it into their game, even if it doesn't fit the style of their game or if it's tacked on as opposed to being sort of integral into the game flow.
Now, I guess there's kind of fashions in monetization as much as there is fashions in everything. You spend a lot of time obviously analyzing games. How quickly do you see that kind of someone does that innovation, someone does the battle pass, and then how quickly are people trying to kind of crowbar that new thing in?
Quite quickly. Ray mentioned, getting a feature, seeing a trend in the market, and then just kind of like a blindly seeing that, okay, that's cool, that's something that a lot of people are doing. Some of them are successful with it. There are plenty of cases we are looking at, for example, in terms of Battle Pass, that it didn't really have any kind of impact or even had a negative impact in the game's economy after they implemented it. So it's, of course, kind of like it can be really, really a good addition for your game. It can be really good to boost up your engagement, boost up your monetization and so on. But there are also dangers, and you really need to think about how you implement it in your specific case.
Dave, I guess the role of a consultant is fairly wide, but I imagine you're probably getting called in to projects that have gone somewhat awry rather than being called in at the start of a project. Would that broadly be correct?
Varies quite a bit. Certainly the most typical use case for our services is a project where either it's in development and somebody's realized that they're in a bit over their head, or the product is actually at market, say in soft launch, and is underperforming. People bring us in for that. We have more and more customers, particularly folks that we've worked with over a number of years, that will now bring us in fairly early to check weaknesses in their concepts, system design, help evaluate prototypes, really help them think about how to evaluate prototypes into games. We love coming in early when we can, because it allows us to have a much greater impact on the outcomes of the game.
I imagine by the time the game's in soft launch, obviously there's always tinkering you can do. And obviously, you know, live ops is now, a lot of things you can do in live ops. But once something's in soft launch, there's sometimes it's probably easy just to say, maybe this game shouldn't be launched, which is maybe, I guess a hard thing to say to anyone, but maybe it's easy. Maybe they bring you in to tell them that.
It happens from time to time. And honestly, sometimes that's the best piece of advice that you can give a client, right? You can look at them and say, look, you can spend another, $500,000, million, $2 million in development funds on this project, but you're fairly unlikely to recoup it in any kind of meaningful margin. Sometimes it's better to just sort of take the learnings and move on. Software is theoretically an infinitely plastic medium. We can make the game do whatever we want. if there is an attached, engaged community, there's always real risk in terms of shifting a lot of the core of a game. So generally, once a game is in soft launch, we are looking to kind of smooth out the imperfections, maybe add on some ancillary systems, subtract a couple of things that don't make sense, do some UI, UX refactoring. But yeah, the earlier we can come in, the more we can shape the system to be effective and performant.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, so if I'm a kind of game designer, I've roughly decided what I'm going to do. How detailed should I be getting into my kind of economy before, you know, in this kind of pre kind of prototyping phase? I guess the temptation is to get really focused on detail and start going down some kind of really some big rabbit holes that I think are going to be big wins for me. But presumably those should be the things that happen right at the end, and you should be looking at the basic kind of flow of how people are coming in and going back to those motivations, what the basic motivations I should be building and making sure that's a really good foundation, and that bit's working before I start getting all carried away in my soft launch.
That's right. Bad game designer, no cookie. we go through a lot. So in addition to our consulting business, we have a co-development business that we work on. We do, you know, games from kickoff through completion. And we put a lot of emphasis on doing system visualizations and thinking through core creative direction issues very early in the process. I am a big fan of whether you do it by hand or use something like machinations or even, you know, lucid charts in terms of really mapping out your game systems visually, understanding what your loops are, understanding where your player motivations are focused and what success means in the game, where you're applying friction and putting on the brakes. Once you start laying that out visually, it helps a lot. Before I even do that and start laying out the system bricks, for me, I like to focus on kind of what is the core fun? What's the player motivation? What are the 3 to 5 things we want to make amazing in this game, and how do we make them shine through? And then build the system that supports that and leverages it, right? But I want to see laid out on paper before I start doing any prototyping, what do I think is the entire system of the game? What are all the key entities? How do they interact with one another? And I just found mapping that out incredibly beneficial, right? It helps you ensure you're putting friction in the right place. It helps you ensure that you don't have any open loops in the game, right? Which is a kind of typical rookie mistake. You have these endless spirals. One other thing I like to look for fairly early, I was sort of hinting at this. When you look at a game that principally rewards engagement rather than skill, you always have an upward economic spiral, right? The canonical form of a core game loop is do X so you can get Y, so you can improve Z, so you can do X better. So you're getting better and better, winning more and more and more, right? It's a positive feedback loop. And if you want the game to retain a sense of challenge and engagement, it's really important that you think about what's going to apply the downward pressure on that loop. What are the brakes that the game is going to put on to ensure that the player doesn't just accelerate out of control? And getting that right so that the player feels a consistent sense of challenge and engagement is a really tricky business, right? There's some stuff that you can do in terms of best practices with the kind of spreadsheet modeling that Ray was talking about to understand how quickly your spiral goes up. But there's also just a lot of experimentation and playtesting and iteration that goes into getting that right.
Yeah, I guess to a degree that's coming back to that's the kind of the economy inflation problem that I guess is kind of quite well known now that, yeah, as players play for longer, they get more stuff in the game, particularly currency. The currency becomes worthless, so you need bigger and bigger things to spend it on, otherwise they're sitting there on millions and millions of in-game currencies. I play a lot of RPGs, and in some ways it's kind of interesting. You talk about kind of slowing, you know, kind of changing the velocity, kind of speeding up and slowing down, and it's always that thing with RPGs where you have to collect to get level one, you level them up, and then you have to like consume one character to get to level two, and then if level two, it's like two characters to level. And by the time you've got to, you know, level six and seven, you're basically it's kind of like years of work to level up all these characters to level up onto the next level, which is, but actually, it feels like quite an accomplishment to do it. In some ways, that kind of model feels quite good. But I like a lot of grindy RPGs.
Well, there's lots of design tricks that go into sort of making that feel right. Mm. If every single player, every single character in the player's inventory is going to take years to level up, and it's 6 months before you hit the next level up of anything, that's when you start to lose people. That's why you balance the inventory with a mix of, you know, kind of higher level and lower level characters, while you're constantly introducing new stuff into the mix, so that while the player is chasing these big goals, it's really important that they have some intermediate goals to chase as well.
Another good thing you mentioned, and obviously key thing, really even more important than monetization, is fun. so these things, I guess some game designers are brilliant at building monetization, and they forget the fun, and that's a bit pointless. I mean, Raymond, do you kind of find that mobile game designers, particularly in the free-to-play space, are now so good, and these techniques are so sophisticated, that sometimes fun is the thing that is kind of like squeezed out of the equation?
I haven't really experienced that with people that I've worked with. I mean, they generally want it to be fun, and they look and focus on the fun. And it's hard for, particularly for people that are new to free to play, to understand that, I guess, very specific, not fun moments of the game is what you need. You need to kind of intersperse these pinch points, in order to have some motivation for the player to want to spend. Within terms of what Dave was saying about having different, short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals and level-ups and things, you know, you remember, you know, you want to have a game that is going to last for years, hopefully, but you also have to remember how fast your team can produce content for it. And so one of the other things that we do is to try and gauge and balance the speed at which the players consume the content, and the speed at which they level up so that they keep interested in the game. So all those things sort of combine together. So you got to make sure that there's, you know, this core thing that you're doing that you have some enjoyment out of, but at the same time, like, things will, you know, be fast in the beginning and then sort of slow down so that you're encouraged to speed them back up again. But you can't like let that go completely off the rails, or you will lose all your free players.
Mm. That's a good point, isn't it? Because it's still the case. I don't know. I know you have the figures, but it's still a very small percentage of people who are playing these free to play games ever spend any money at all. Obviously, there's now billions of people playing these games, so potentially that's to be expected because the audience has got so big. But it's, I think, if a game's getting 3% of its audience to monetize, that would be seen as fairly successful. It depends on the genre, I suppose. So.
Well, it depends very much on your definition of to monetize, right?
Okay.
So in our experience, if you have a game that has robust monetization systems, it's really not that uncommon to see, say, 3% of daily players converting on any given day, right, in a well-monetized game. If you think about how many players will convert over the course of their lifetime, obviously a lot of those are repeat purchasers, but you're looking often for a number that's more like, say, 10%, maybe a little bit higher, of players will convert at some point for at least one transaction. So that 3% figure, I think, is a little bit misleading, right? People assume that that's the number of people who ever transact. But yeah, we see games that convert 3% a day.
Well, that's much higher than I've ever heard of. That's good. That's good news. But
and the other thing to remember too is that the longer the player stays in the game, the more likely they are to eventually monetize. So that longevity, that keeping that interest going, is also very important for monetization.
That said, though, you want to make sure that your game is not exclusively focused on late monetization.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
When players monetize early, they have more of a tendency to retain, right? There's some causation questions there, but part of that is certainly sunk cost. Mm-hmm. Once you start paying for a game, you start to feel invested. You want to stick around. You want to retain and make good on that investment. And some of your players simply won't retain, right? Even, you know, really high retaining games have lost whatever, 70, 75% of their players after a week. So you do want to make sure that you have some early monetization opportunity in place for those players who bounce. But for the long-term health of your game, to be able to convert it into a hobby, you really need those kind of deep recurring spending opportunities for players that have been playing months and years.
I know. What sort of player are you when you play a game? Are you someone who goes in and goes for the obvious kind of here's the really cheap kind of pack that gives you loads of value and see how experiences, or are you more canny with your money? You want to play for a bit and see.
Okay, for me personally, so well, basically for my job, I have to play so many of these games, so it depends a lot, and it needs quite a special game, to be honest, for me to retain on that for a very long time, even on my free time. But I would say, I think, again, this is kind of like the same story all over again. But again, going back to the battle passes, and if you have, for example, listened to the great video that the Supercell guys made about their approach to Clash of Clans battle pass, which is something basically they were talking about the amount of players that converted after they implemented the battle pass, because it gives a kind of like a good first step for many of the non-payers in the game to go for the first transaction, and then of course getting more engaged into the game and so on. So I would say, like, personally, those type of features I like, because I'm as a player, I'm a huge kind of like sucker for anything to kind of like progressing or giving me more and more of layers to progress in. So that's why, for example, Battle Pass is something that I have, probably a feature that I have bought in the most of the games that I have played, or played even a bit more, because it's usually an easy first step for the non-payers, and then it gives me the sense of kind of like a progression, or having another progression layer for the game, and giving me the satisfaction of completing milestones and so on.
And I guess what's interesting about the battle pass is it does kind of create a kind of unified shop front that even if you're not spending money, you're kind of still part of the battle. You know, you have the kind of the free option. So I guess in this way of kind of getting a balance between people who want to pay, the battle pass is good. The people who don't want to pay get some of the battle pass, but also the reason it's been successful in the genres it has been successful is it's actually a very good kind of incentive to take some of the non-payers into the paying option, particularly because it has this limited time kind of frame as well. And we all know how retailing works. If it's a closing down sale, one day only sort of thing, that just drives us to FOMO.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. There's the FOMO effect on it also, as you see that, okay, I have completed the 50 levels of it already, so now I'm getting even more value out of it. But then again, something that we have seen in the market with the battle pass implementations, for example, is different companies have been starting to kind of like implement more and more kind of like a subscription type of elements to the battle pass. So the players would convert in the very early kind of like a phase of the seasons and so on. So like for example, what Playrix does with their Gardenscapes and Homescapes and Fishdom battle passes, you get the special perks for the duration of the season. So it's not just like the rewarded tiers that you progress in, but do you actually have kind of like this slight small elements of actually subscription plans with the battle pass?
Okay, good. So we've covered a lot of stuff there. I wonder if we can put our crystal balls on, but we don't put crystal balls on. We look into crystal balls. If we can look into crystal balls, I was thinking about a hat. There must be a hat and a crystal ball, wizard hats or something. I don't know. how do we think this is going to kind of play out over the next year? Do we kind of think the same trends are going to continue? There's going to be this kind of mashing up. There's going to be this ever kind of greater level of kind of sophistication of how these kind of economies are being built, or do we still think there's an opportunity for something kind of quite disruptive to come into kind of game economy design and really kind of change the status quo? Dave, what do you think on that?
Well, it's kind of a tough question, right? Disruptions are always waiting in the wing, but the way of these disruptions is there's something that's maybe on one or two people's mind. They execute it, they demonstrate success, and then the market rushes in and fills the void, right? Battle passes weren't really super prominent until we started seeing them really roll out in, you know, Fortnite and Battle Royales broadly, where they started to get a lot of traction. And then casual game designers looked at it and said, hey, I can see how this maps in. There's a constancy of crazy experiments out there, right? How many millions of mobile games are live right now? And as those get tractions, we'll start to see it come in. I do think we're going to see a lot of evolution in existing mechanics, especially around the battle pass, right? They've rolled in elements of a lot of older monetization mechanics like, you know, currency subscriptions, right? And now kind of rolled in VIP programs has sort of rolled in there. So I think we're going to see a lot of iteration there. In terms of what the next breakthrough is, I'll know it when I see it making a bunch of money.
But I guess that is a good point there's plenty of innovation out there. There's plenty of smart people thinking about these things and trying it out. Kind of part of the acceptance comes from audience acceptance as well, because if an audience doesn't really understand what something is, then it's obviously not going to monetize. Whereas if suddenly, you know, the audience kind of get it, then then it becomes the audience almost want it in their game as well. Do you think that's correct, Ray? Should we be also kind of, you know, going full circle and kind of putting the audience into part of this in terms of what they can actually kind of get their heads around?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, you know, when you put these features in your game, you're gonna we want to track them and see how they do. But it really depends on what you think your audience is or who your audience is with your game. But I've seen lots of cross-pollinization in places like, you know, talking about Battle Pass coming from Fortnite and then seeing it into Clash Royale. You know, there's like a long-standing feature in casino games, the social casino games, the piggy bank, but now you're seeing the piggy bank in idle games and some other sorts of things. So there becomes this sort of cross-pollinization where people go, well, maybe my audience would like that feature, would accept that feature, and you put it in and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. The good game designer is borrowing or stealing from everywhere, I suppose. They're not just playing their own genres. They're going widely across the world of mobile games. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I think that is a wrap for today. We've covered a lot of stuff. I've certainly learned things, so that's good. So I can only hope the audience has learned some things as well. Thanks for your time, Erno.
Thank you.
And thanks, Dave and Ray, for your expertise.
Thanks so much for having us on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
And of course, talking of audience acceptance, thank you, listeners, listener acceptance. So we hope you've enjoyed that. We are releasing new podcasts on what's going on in the world of mobile games and all those trends every month. So if you haven't subscribed already, please do so. We are available through the usual podcast channels. And if you like us, write a review. That's really good. That helps other people find us as well. But thank you very much for listening to this episode, and come back next time and see what's going on in the world of mobile games then. Goodbye.